first you told us only through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood, fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few, but about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores, but because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you say these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the water all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own Western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the music all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would own everything all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
Good evening and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for January 16th, 2025. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. This coming Tuesday, January 21st, is the 15th anniversary of the Supreme Court's infamous decision called Citizens United, in which the court held, by a 5-4 vote, that the freedom of speech clause of the Constitution's First Amendment prohibits the government from restricting independent expenditures for political campaigns by corporations, including for-profit corporations, nonprofit organizations, labor unions, and other similar associations. Now that it's 2 months since the November elections, enough is known about spending in the election to discuss the influence of huge donations enabled by that Citizens United decision. So with us today to discuss money in the November elections is Anna Masolia, the recent founder of Influence Brief, after nearly a decade as manager of editorial content and investigations at Open Secrets. Ms. Masolia is an investigative journalist and political finance expert with over a decade of experience exposing political spending, lobbying activities, foreign influence, and opaque financial networks. Her work has been featured by CNN, NPR, Good Morning America, CBS News, PBS NewsHour, The Washington Post, The New York Times, and that list goes on. She holds degrees in psychology and political science from North Carolina State University, and a J.D. law degree from the School of Law at the University of the District of Columbia. Her initial career was as a research analyst and editor at Bloomberg Tax. So her new gig, again, Influence Brief, is a trusted source of uncovering the money, power, and influence driving politics today. In a world where political decisions are often shaped behind closed doors, Influence Brief gives an inside look at the networks of money, lobbying, and dark influence impacting the government. So let's look at money in the November elections, 15 years after Citizens United. Anna Masolia, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Once again, we have a historic election. Unfortunately, it's for historic amounts of money spent. How bad was it?
It was unprecedented, which has actually become the norm. So pretty much every recent election cycle, we have seen record sums of money flooding into U.S. elections. Every year, it's kind of upping the ante for more influence, more money, primarily targeting the bigger races. So things like presidential races tend to attract the most money. High-profile races in swing districts, Senate races, as well as some House races, really attracting, in some cases, millions and even hundreds of millions of dollars for each different race. All in all, Open Secrets calculated that the projected total for the elections is going to reach about billion, billion with a B, not million. Wild to think of, but there's still filings coming in. We're following the Federal Election Commission filings are coming in the week after next, so there could still be even more increases and adjustments to that, but by far, absolutely unprecedented already.
Yeah, so that's a huge jump, and like you say, that's now normal to have a huge jump each time, and do we get to blame a lot of this on what Steve mentioned earlier, the Citizens United decision? Is that behind most of our problem here?
It's absolutely behind some of the big spending. Citizens United really opened the door for groups like super PACs to be able to start spending on U.S. elections. And just to give some definitions so everyone knows what I'm talking about here, super PACs are groups that can spend on what are called independent expenditures. So political ads that either support or oppose a candidate. And these groups can raise and spend unlimited sums on elections. Unlike traditional candidate committees and party committees, they can take as much money as they want from a billionaire, from a corporation. There's no limits on how much each billionaire can give, and they can also spend unlimited sums on the candidates. And so this has really driven up spending in the years since Citizens United was decided in 2010. Every year, we've seen more and more money going in from these outside groups like super PACs, as well as from hybrid PACs, which are a type of hybrid super PAC, as well as other types of groups like dark money groups, which tend to be politically active nonprofits that are spending on elections that don't even disclose their donors. And so not only are we seeing more money, we're seeing less disclosure of that money as it pours in, which makes it even harder to track, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars.
We've seen it used in some really imaginative ways this time to pay for legal fees for criminal charges. Is that legal?
It really depends on who's spending and how they're spending it. There really is a wide range of ways that political action committees can spend their funding from different donors. It depends on the type of committee. Campaign committees tend to be a little bit more restricted. They can only take a certain amount of money from every donor. It's a few thousand dollars, which, while it could sound like a lot to the average American, is actually not much compared to the millions of dollars one mega donor could give to a super PAC. They're also restricted a bit more in how they can spend, where they can spend on election-related activity, but anything that would be, for example, for the personal benefit of a candidate, they're not supposed to be doing. To give one example of this cycle of how we're kind of pushing the brim on some of those rules that used to not really come into play that much. We saw Trump's campaign, his political action committee, and even to some extent the Republican Party, spending on legal fees for the now president-elect. And this was something that, if it is related to the campaign, the FEC has a lot of very complicated rules on this, but if it's related to the campaign, if it's not for his personal benefit, that is something that the campaign can even spend on. We also saw his political action committee, Save America PAC, spend even more. And this is, again, millions and millions of dollars going into legal fees for the now president-elect. But we're also seeing even more money going into political ads, to outreach to different individuals and voting and voters, to voter promotion. So getting people to actually show up to the polls. And so there's a lot of other messaging as well. It's not just the legal fees that they're spending on. There's so many different ways that they're reaching out to voters and promoting candidates, a lot of rally spending, a lot of political ad spending. One thing that I think is really interesting is it's not necessarily trying to convince voters to change their mind. It's trying to target the right type of voter that will actually come out and go vote. And so it's pulling people out of the woodworks who would be more likely to support one candidate or another, but who might not decide to go to the ballot box, might not decide to ask for an absentee ballot. And so getting those people to be motivated enough to go out. And so it's a little bit of not just persuading people, but also at least persuading people on how they want to vote, but getting them motivated enough to actually get out there. And in some cases, also suppressing the vote and demotivating people from going out.
They work on both ends of it here. Another thing I thought was interesting is that the billionaires are giving millions to Trump's inauguration, and that's money that he can spend for personal reasons.
The inauguration this time has also been really interesting to follow. One of the differences between Trump's first inauguration and this inauguration is that we are seeing many companies and billionaires coming out and publicly announcing their support of Trump. When Trump first was a candidate for president before he has established a lot of his reputation now, he was not necessarily a popular candidate. He was a risk for different companies to support. Traditionally, companies have, in particular corporations, have given in a way that's generally pretty bipartisan, depending on the company, but also in a way that hedges their bets, even if they are in a more partisan light, where they're not taking chances on challengers to candidates. They're not taking chances on someone who isn't considered to have a chance in office. Mm-hmm. Now that Trump is more of a sure thing and is now elected to office, we're seeing a number of these corporations that had previously shunned him or even had issues with him coming in and trying to mend these rifts by giving money to the inauguration. And now public, not only giving, but publicly announcing it in a way that they're basically making an apology tour in the media. And so I think that's been a really interesting trend this cycle, seeing all these companies come into and even physically going to Mar-a-Lago to effectively kiss the ring. Mm-hmm. And so that's really one of the phenomena that I think is so fascinating this cycle. We also don't really know the full extent of inaugural giving at this point, since we know how much companies have said they are giving, but we don't know whether those companies actually followed through until disclosures are filed several weeks after the inauguration itself. Mm-hmm. There's also other ways that we're seeing companies and even billionaires currying influence with Trump and other members of the administration as a part of the inauguration. So we're seeing them not just fund the formal inaugural fund and committee. We're also seeing funding of parties, funding of different events around the inauguration, busing people in as a way to really support in a way that's not as direct, but also to get people in the room. It's not just about buying influence and favor. It's also about buying access and getting the right people in the right place to connect.
I haven't heard about this before. Are they busing anyone in so that the crowd is larger than 8 years ago?
I can't say I know the specifics of any of that, but that's certainly a possibility. But I can't say I've seen any evidence of that. But more just making sure the right people are in the right place. Yeah. I think the bigger, at least what I've seen evidence of so far, is getting the right lobbyists and influencers and company heads in the room with either people who might be staffers in the next administration or in positions of power with the next administration so that they can start to build those relationships and get favorable regulations or policies.
Yeah, the amount of money by individuals is like completely amazing. In a recent article, you said that a third of Trump's money comes from three donors, Mellon, Musk, and Adelson.
It really is wild. And one of the other things that's really interesting about that is so much of it came in during the final weeks and months of the election cycle. Just to make sure to clarify that number, that's not just Trump's campaign, which is limited in the amount it can take from individual donors. Each individual donor can only give a few thousand dollars. It's also including those super PACs, which are technically supposed to be independent committees, which is why they're able to get unlimited sums from each donor. But in many cases, due to loopholes that have eroded over the years, these groups can be very close with the candidate themselves. They can feature the candidate at events. And so the line between where these technically outside groups like super PACs and the campaign and the candidate is increasingly blurry. And so we're seeing, for example, Elon Musk, his political committee, America PAC, as well as some other political committees that he funded, featuring Trump, basically almost indistinguishable from the campaign in some cases.
Yeah, I guess the FCC, they made a decision that it was okay for this connection between the PAC and the campaign, that they actually are working together, even though we always thought they weren't supposed to.
In some cases, it's the absence of a decision that is really enabling this to flourish. There have been so many even brazen examples of candidates attending events with super PACs of, for example, candidates engage in a practice called red boxing in some cases, where they have their campaign site and they put a strategy or things they'd really like to see in, for example, political ads on that site. They publish a paragraph, they put a big red box around it, and it's basically instructing a super PAC of what they political ads. They could even provide B-roll footage, so footage of the candidate, post that on the site for the super PAC to use. And because they're technically making it publicly available, that doesn't count as coordination, assuming certain rules are followed. And so there's so many ways that the FEC has either not had the resources to investigate, has not agreed to investigate due to gridlock and just a constant deadlock within the FEC, or just has looked the other way.
Yeah, I would like to talk about the FEC and the gridlock in a minute to get back to all this money. To contrast Harris with Trump, Trump had a third of his money from three donors, and Harris's top 10 only accounted for 8% of her campaign contributions. That's staggeringly different.
And that's certainly not the absence of big donors for Harris, though. And sorry to interrupt, but no, certainly not the absence of big donors. We were still seeing some major donors giving to super PACs for Harris, but the sheer scale of those three major Trump donors coming in the final months of the election cycle was unprecedented and completely blew out of the water all of the other major donors that had committed to Harris's campaign. And honestly, were much bigger than even the prior years.
What can you tell us about where such huge sums of money went? What did they fund in those last weeks or month or two? You know, how much is
Sure. So it's a wide range of different things. There certainly was a lot of social media ads, still a lot of television ads. Social media ads tend to be a bit cheaper than TV ads, and so they're able to devote less money to that in many cases, but still have an even greater reach, which is, I think, one of the interesting trends in recent years, where we're seeing candidates and political groups increasingly looking to online ads as a cheap way to reach really huge audiences without having the cost of TV ads. We're still seeing a lot of both of those, as well as with micro-targeting with the online ads. That's, I think, really been one of the draws of that, is they can not only reach huge audiences for cheaper, but also if they just want to reach a very specific audience. That's been one thing that we've really seen. And also a big part of the spending strategy, I think, in the final months of the election was political committees targeting really specific populations, demographics. So, for example, pro-Trump political committees targeting Democratic voting blocks and pitting them against each other. And so that's kind of where that voter suppression, to some extent, for lack of a better term, comes in. And so we're seeing a lot of that. Also seeing a lot of just old-fashioned door knocking, getting people to go out to vote, making sure they're aware of the election and have a way to get there. Seeing a lot of spending on events. We also saw some less traditional spending from groups like America PAC, which is funded in part and affiliated with Elon Musk, where they were putting out, to some extent, a reward for people to go and enlist voters, which became very controversial because it is not legal to pay people to vote or register to vote, but they had basically an incentive for people to do that. Mm-hmm.
This is the $1 million a day lottery.
Yes.
So we talk a little bit about the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. So the Republicans have more money from fewer people, but as you point out, the Democrats are getting a lot of big donations too. And Chris Hedges said something about the difference, in his opinion, was that the Democrats had corporate interests and the Republicans had oligarchic interests. Does that compute?
I think it's a bit of both for both sides of the political committee, just looking at the actual campaign finances. Certainly this cycle, the most influential donors were people like Elon Musk, Timothy Mellon, who had not been very active in prior cycles, who effectively came out. Elon Musk in particular had very little history whatsoever, whereas Mellon in the most recent few election cycles has started to increase his influence in the political spectrum. But certainly we did see these few huge individuals giving unprecedented sums of money to the on the Republican side, in particular in support of Trump. That's not to say that there weren't big billionaires on the side of Harris. We did see, for example, like a variety of different people, like the Soroses and all that. But a lot of it wasn't necessarily direct, I think, is one of the big issues. So mm-hmm. the main super PAC that was affiliated with Kamala Harris and Biden before her with the presidential cycle was Future Forward. And one of its biggest donors was also Future Forward USA, which the similar name is not a coincidence. It's a 501c4 politically active nonprofit that's affiliated with the super PAC. And one of the loopholes, to some extent, that the Federal Election Commission has left in place is that super PACs, which can raise and spend unlimited sums, do need to disclose their donors, but they can just disclose another nonprofit that's affiliated with them. Basically, they can disclose a group that doesn't have to disclose its donors, ultimately hiding the source of funding. And so we also saw a much larger amount and portion of dark money going in to support Harris, as well as Democrats generally. And so it's hard to say what composed that dark money, because we don't even know who the donors were that were supporting that.
I think my favorite super PAC is the RG, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the RBG super PAC that was supposed to demonstrate that Trump favored abortion rights. But
another Musk creation.
Yeah, that was just crazy. So people that were seeing that didn't really know, as you point out to all of them, they don't know where that money is actually coming from.
Any comment you can make on foreign money coming into the election? And one way it might be able to come in, but you know certainly more than I, is on the inauguration events. I don't know if there's limitations on legal limitations. I know there's supposed to be on campaign funding, but we don't know how well those are followed. So what can you tell us about foreign money coming in to the elections and the inauguration?
Thank you. That's a great point, and really plays to the point I was making earlier about we really don't know the funding that's going into certain groups. Mm-hmm. Foreign money, so money from foreign nationals specifically, is barred in U.S. elections. So you can't have a foreign individual or a foreign company that is only abroad giving to a super PAC or to a candidate directly or getting involved in the outcome of the election. That said, there are so many different ways that groups or individuals can funnel money into U.S. elections that's not detectable. And so there may be interference that we just haven't identified yet. Just looking at the most recent election cycles, we saw money going in through shell companies, such as limited liability companies that were formed in a way that was very opaque. And without following the money trail very extensively, we wouldn't know that it actually had a foreign source. And so they're not necessarily disclosing to the Federal Election Commission, we got this money from a foreign individual or from a foreign government. It's a lot more following the investigative, pulling on the strings to see where it goes. Mm-hmm. This cycle, there has not been a lot of high profile cases in the way there were in prior Trump elections, where we saw, of course, the call for Russia to interfere and all of those things. But that's not to say it wasn't there, because there's so many different ways that money can go into elections without us knowing. And so I think that it's worth following to see what else comes out as we're continuing to get these disclosures in. And there are also so many different groups that were contributing to super PACs or spending directly, in particular on online ads, which are subject to less disclosure, that we just don't know who was funding them. We don't know a lot of details about them. And so there's a lot of questions that still remain about who was funding them in particular and what interest they had in funding them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. One thing that's really hard for me to wrap my mind around is that of these super PACs, 96% of the money behind these super PACs come from the top 10%. So our elections are being decided by, a couple thousand people, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there is the one person, one vote, but some people may have more influence than others on how people vote. And I think that that's a really important point to put out there, where we do see this small circle of billionaires and influential individuals who are in a financial position to have this outsized influence on elections. And they're not buying votes. They're not buying a person getting an office. It's more complicated than that, but they are able to elevate a candidate in a way that that candidate wouldn't be able to do without funding. One trend, at least in recent years, that we've seen is that rise of grassroots donors, for better or worse. We are seeing it becoming more accessible for the average person to give to political committees or to candidates through sites like Act Blue and Win Red, which are making it very easy to just give $5 or a dollar. This has also contributed to the, proliferation of online advertisements, where they're targeting people to then do that. And so it's not that these two things are mutually exclusive. If you have enough money to target people to give, it's kind of a system that's building on itself.
So what about the Fair Elections Commission? Where are they?
Yes. The Federal Elections Commission. Are they awake?
That's a great question. The Federal Elections Commission has a complicated history. For several years, they did not even have enough commissioners to have what's called a quorum. That means they couldn't even have enough commissioners to vote on whether to pursue enforcement action. Thankfully, they do have enough commissioners now, but due to the structure of the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, it constantly ends up in deadlocks where the conservatives against the liberals, and they can't even decide not on whether or not someone's guilty, whether or not they're innocent, whether they should be fined, whether to even investigate things, even when there's very well-documented facts that violations could have taken place. And so I think that's one of the big issues, is it's not that they're doing things that are actively subverting elections or making it worse, not necessarily. It's that the absence of enforcement in many cases. There are some examples, but they're understaffed, under-resourced, and the very structure goes against the ability to be able to make decisions and enforce these actions.
So there's like three commissioners that are appointed that have to be Republicans and three that have to be Democrats. So you have an instant tie there and can't move. Is that part of it?
Basically, yes. Some cases there are more cross-partisan issues that they do agree on. But those are few and far between and tend to be less controversial, but also less meaningful issues in many cases.
Let me mention to listeners, we're speaking with Anna Masoli. She's the founder of a new effort called Influence Brief, but has spent almost a decade with Open Secrets. And we're talking about money in the November elections, particularly in light of the 15-year anniversary of the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court. That's coming up next week. Oh, if anyone would like to call in with any questions, the number here, 895-2448. That's in area code 707, 895-2448.
And then back at the Federal Fair Funny Elections Commission, even though they have this 3-3 tie going between the two major parties' appointees, I think lately we've had the Biden appointee is voting with the Republicans, and so then it's not even a tie. It's one idea is permeating that whole commission then, I guess, and that idea might be for a lot more money and a lot more elections.
That's a great point. And I think one thing that a lot of people don't always realize is that corruption and lack of transparency around political finances isn't a one-sided issue. It's happening, unfortunately, by both major political parties. We're seeing some of the biggest actions to erode transparency and open loopholes for practically unlimited spending with very little disclosure coming from in some cases, Democratic attorneys who have it in their financial interest to be able to do this because they are working for political committees or dark money groups. And there are some big names, I'm not going to call anyone out, on the left as well as the right, who have really eroded these rules over the years, because it's not just about, oh, this side or that. It's not about ideology. It's about creating their financial interest and the ability to align their own pockets in many cases.
So for a cure here, we have the FEC, the aforementioned FEC. And then the other way to attack these problems would be legislatively, I imagine. What can the people do through our legislature, our Congress? How can we get this under control?
There's a number of different reforms that could potentially happen. The Federal Election Commission is limited in some of the changes that it can make, for example, on mandating certain types of donor disclosure. So I think having more robust transparency measures could certainly be a step in the right direction. But it's not just about passing new laws or making new policies or even changes. It's also about enforcing the laws on the books, which I think is a really important part of that. You can pass all the good laws you want, and if they're not enforced, they're not actually coming into play, people aren't following them, and there's no consequences for actions, then the meaning for them is really... is not there.
Okay, so we have a lot of good laws, but there's no enforcement.
In many cases, unfortunately, yes, the system has not lent itself to that. And at the state level, there are some great pushes for increasing transparency, for providing more donor disclosure, but every legislature is different there. And there's also concerted efforts of resistance among different nonprofits that don't want to disclose their donors or groups that are already benefiting from the existing policies. So I think you have those two issues. One, there are some policies that are not lending themselves to transparency, to accountability, but also even when you do have the good laws on the books or laws that are lending themselves to that type of enforcement, people just aren't following the rules. And also there aren't really many consequences for their actions. The agencies and regulators and government officials who are tasked with oversight have not been as aggressive as they could be. They're just not enforcing the laws on the books in many cases, not due to their own fault in every case, but also due to just the way the system is set up and also under resources.
Okay, so then do we fight dark money with dark money?
I'd like to think not, but that argument has been made by many people, in particular on the left, where they'll, where when there have been has been pressure to disclose donors, they say, oh, well, we're going to be at a disadvantage. We have the right views. And again, just projecting what I've heard from a variety of different political operatives who think they have the right thing. They want to make sure their agenda is promoted and feel that they're at a disadvantage if they're not utilizing all the tools on the table. But unfortunately, coming from a money and politics tracking perspective, coming from that oversight and watchdog perspective, it's not just fighting fire with fire, it's feeding the fire. And I think that that's an important point that people don't always notice, that it's not just coming, it's build, making it bigger, it's making it harder, it's tactics used by one side then get adopted by the other, and it just perpetuates the issues.
Let's take our first call here. Hello, caller, you're live on the air. What's your first name and from where are you calling? Let's try that again. Caller, you're live on the air. Hello. What's your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, hi, this is Sandy in Fort Bragg.
Hi, Sandy.
Howdy. I appreciate the show. I've got a comment and a question. The comment is around, you mentioned Citizens United is coming up to the 15-year mark, and mm-hmm. right around that time was, right after that, was Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Ukiah. One of my favorite signs that I ever made said, I'll believe that corporations are people when Texas executes one.
Mm-hmm.
I copied it from somebody else. It wasn't my original. And my question of the guest is, has she studied other countries that seem to have an election process that might be worth copying in the United States? Obviously, the United States is a big country in terms of millions of people and a lot of real estate. It's a big country in terms of square miles. But does she have any recommendations?
Okay, what do you think?
Okay.
Thank you so much for the comment. I also think that's a great message on the sign. I can't say endorse or not, but I think that that's a fun message. But also looking at other countries, I have looked at the systems in other countries. A group called International Idea does some really great research on that if you're ever looking to read up more. I can't say that there's one country that I look to that has all of the answers. I wish that that was the case, but there are a number of different countries that have increased transparency, but there's also the issue that other countries are facing different problems and a very different scale of money than the United States has. This is something that's built up over several decades, where money is flooding our system. I was looking at a comparison just of the amount of money that the individuals in the United States give to political committees and spend on elections versus other countries. And just our spending is more than the entire GDP of multiple countries added together in some cases. Mm. And it really is unprecedented. I can't think of another country that has reached the scale of the United States. I think we're very unique in that. And that is based on the fact that I've looked at the numbers just this year, where it is much larger. There are some countries that have at least some money in politics, just not quite at the scale of ours, but have increased transparency measures around it. But many of the countries also have, even if they look like they're doing the right thing and they don't have a lot of money in politics or they don't appear to have influence, a lot of the things are happening behind the scenes when there are regulations saying, oh, there should not be money in politics, or putting these restrictions on people. And so in some cases, it just becomes harder to track. Every country really has their own challenges as well as benefits to their system. I can't say that there's one that's jumped out at me as being worth following, but increasingly the issues that we are facing in the United States are being exported to other countries as well. So I think looking at all the different systems is really important. Just recently, of course, with Musk going to the UK and a variety of other countries, has spurred a conversation in some of those countries about whether or not foreign money should be acceptable in those countries. And that's a conversation we're having in the United States as well. So I think that there's certainly a lot to learn from other countries that are dealing with, even if not the same issues, similar issues throughout, so that we can learn from the lessons that have been learned in other places.
And let's clarify. So what has Musk done recently or proposed recently in another country? And there's more than one of them, I think. But
There's a few examples of this. The one I was thinking of most recently was Musk announcing support within the UK and kind of exploring the idea of pumping money into UK elections. But that is not the only country that Musk has expressed this interest in. And so that's been something that has really caused a reexamination of whether or not foreign money should be acceptable there, how it should be disclosed. And it's a conversation we're having in the US as well. Currently, foreign national money is not legal in the US. Musk is legally an American citizen, but it's happening about other donors that are not. And so I think that that's something that's kind of interesting to see multiple different governments grappling with the same issue. And it's certainly something important across the board. Different types of governance structures may come down on it differently, but certainly an important thing to consider.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like the UK might not have specific laws against foreign nationals contributing to in their elections.
Just reconsidering it, but yeah. But it depends how it goes with all of this.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners again, so if you want to get in a question or comment, 895-2448 in area code 707.
One thing that does seem hopeful is there's a scattering of local governments that have public campaign financing programs. Can you talk about how that works?
Sure. So within the United States, there's a number of different state level and municipality level programs that have been implemented to incentivize small donors. Basically, if a donor gives under a certain amount, their money is doubled or just matched in some way by funding from the government. Oftentimes, this is funded by fines against committees that do something wrong, but every government has like kind of a little bit different system for that. But in order to make sure it's not just taxpayers footing the bill, they're coming up with ways that it can pay for itself. But basically just incentivizing these small donors to be able to have a bigger impact. So if someone, for example, gives $200, that could be $400, which again is still very small compared to the millions and hundreds of millions of dollars some mega donors are giving, but can make someone feel like they can have more impact and collectively contribute to that grassroots support. This system has increased things like turnout, increased voter engagement in some areas, but it's also been exploited in some circumstances, unfortunately. One recent example of this was Eric Adams in New York, who, or at least allegedly, fudged some of the numbers in order to take advantage of small dollar funding. And in some cases, it's going to be to the tune of millions of dollars collectively from a number of small dollar donors.
Yeah, that's the current mayor of New York City.
correct. Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay. So yeah, you can mess up anything, I guess. It seems like some of that matching, heavy matching funds, and would do away with, has the potential of doing away with some of this outrageously huge spending. And in New York, there was an added provision that the matching money had to be raised from constituents, which I think is kind of an important element, rather than have outside money flowing into town.
Absolutely. And that's something that I've also followed in recent years, is kind of the rise of out-of-state money in state-level elections, even local elections, as well as federal elections. This is something that, as elections are becoming increasingly expensive, we're seeing both those grassroots donors, small donors, being able to very easily through the internet give money, but also big donors becoming increasingly interested in the affairs of states that are not their own. And so that's been kind of an interesting phenomenon, in particular with ballot measures, where the actual policies that are on the books, they might have a specific issue that they're interested in across the country. And so we have seen that increase in out-of-state funding and out-of-state influence. So effectively, politics are becoming increasingly nationalized. Even if it's just a city council election, in some cases, you can see national groups that have a specific policy agenda may see an interest in getting a certain person in office, even if that's at the local or state level. But especially at the congressional level, many members of Congress or the Senate are funded even predominantly from out-of-state donors. It's more common for those in party leadership, of whether or not, I don't know if that's expected or not, but for me, that surprised me. So as you work your way up through the party, as you become more well-known in Congress, to some extent, this makes sense, you have a higher profile, you have a higher likelihood of out-of-state donors. In some cases, more than 90% may come from people, not only just not your constituents, but not even in your state.
So the other thing that I don't quite understand, but I hear a lot, is that when you have the national donors, you have a greater tendency toward extremism.
That is something I have seen. It has been misinterpreted in some forums, but certainly there is an overlap between candidates who are either further right or further left, or just have a bigger profile, because I think that there's a lot of overlap between those things, do tend to get more money from smaller donors. I don't think it's necessarily a causation. We don't know enough about it for that, but certainly there is a correlation between candidates that are more outspoken, more extreme, tend to get more media. They tend to be more well-known nationally, which can tend to attract donors that are outside of their state. So as candidates get that higher profile, which oftentimes is accompanied by them being outspoken, they tend to attract those out-of-state donors. And this is something that's really fueled by the accessibility of online platforms for donations, the increase in online ads, making it much easier for individuals in any state, if they see someone that they're interested in, to be able to donate to. And not saying that's good or bad, but certainly there is a correlation between that, but it's not always a bad thing.
So Move to Amend has been trying to get enough support to do away with Citizens United and the designation of corporations as persons. What do you think about that campaign? Is that a good way to go? Do you think they can do it?
I can't say that I know enough about like constitutional amendments and all that to know the viability of it. Certainly, Citizens United has had a huge impact in federal elections and elections generally within the United States since it was passed in 2010. One thing about, I think, some of the efforts to overturn Citizens United is it's not just Citizens United that's the problem. Certainly, Citizens United was an impetus for this increase in money in politics, for the rise of super PACs, but there's so many other systems currently in place that even if we did overturn that one Supreme Court case, there's so many other issues at this point that it's already spread to, that it's hard to kind of put it back in the bottle, so to speak. Since there's so many other things in place that wouldn't necessarily go away if Citizens United is overturned.
Yeah, that's the proverbial corporations or people issue that Move to Amend is focused on.
It's a strange situation because there's been more than one study that show that most Americans believe that the system is slanted toward the wealthy, and they don't like it, and they don't want money to buy elections. So if most of the overwhelming number of us don't agree with this buying of elections, how come we have it?
That is a great question. And I think it gets at an even deeper point of, are our representatives really in office to represent us? Because I think in many cases, as you mentioned, polling does show people don't want money to have as big of an influence as it does in elections. But when it push comes to shove, the lawmakers who in office, by and large, don't vote in that way. They don't propose bills in that way. And even if they do, oftentimes it's when those bills are less likely to be passed. And so it's a point worth making is that it is not necessarily in lawmakers' best interest to overturn Citizens United and to even erode money in politics generally, because they are benefiting from it. It is the system that has gotten them in office that keeps incumbents in office. And so it's not necessarily in their interest to do so, even though their job is technically to be representing the interests of the people that are in their district. Okay.
In theory. Once again, 895-2448, if anyone would like to get in a question or comment, 895-2448.
And then, of course, when we're talking about the imbalance of campaign contributions, the short end of the stick for many people, the women, people of color, LGBTQ people, it falls on the least able to deal with the problem, it seems.
Yes. Research I've seen, Open Secrets did some research on this last year and the year before, looking at women are less likely to give. So women don't tend to be donors as much. They don't tend to have money that's disposable for that. But they also, when they do run for office, tend to get much smaller sums from people. So they don't tend to benefit from the system. The same goes for people of color, people from anything that's not, frankly, a white male. And so anyone who doesn't fit this traditional demographic that benefits from that system tends to get lower donations on average and in total. But certainly that's something that grassroots support has been changing, and different changes in the system and involvement. We're seeing some big firsts of people becoming lawmakers, the first in their states or even in the country. And so there is progress being made, but it's hard within the existing system.
Yeah, one thing I do keep reading also is that becoming cynical and giving up is not going to work either. So you really need to keep plugging away at it. And I think that there's ways that we can do that you've been talking about, some of them. And like just now when you're saying that there's new people that are elected, we can certainly be working with some of the new people. We had Greg Palast on our show a couple months ago to talk about the voter suppression knocking particularly black voters off the rolls, hundreds of thousands of them. And you said something interesting about a different form of voter suppression where you have little campaigns that kind of discourage people to go to the polls in the first place. You mentioned that a little earlier in the show, and I was curious about that. Do you want to elaborate?
Sure. So I think voter suppression can take a number of different forms. One of the things that we saw increase this cycle was different political groups and nonprofits targeting very key demographics, in particular among traditional Democratic voting blocks, and pit them against each other, making them question whether it was worth going out to vote. We saw them pushing, and again, this happens on both sides of the aisle, but many of the biggest examples were in the presidential election, with the Republican side targeting Democratic side, at least in the most recent cycle, of political groups pushing these wedge issues that were more likely to peel off these key demographics that in a tight race were really necessary. This was things like advertising, highlighting Harris's husband's ethnicity and religion, highlighting a variety of different tropes with that, highlighting race, and basically getting into these really messy areas that highlighted areas where certain people might question that, basically hitting one demographic against another. And I think that that's something that it's something that we've seen recently, but not in a good way. And that's something that we've seen, I think, the last few election cycles, but this election cycle has been uniquely yeah, hitting below the belt, for lack of a better term, where it's really pitting people against each other.
Yeah, I see a lot of that. We're all seeing that now. In fact, there's a lot of people are worried more about that than anything else, I guess. So what are you going to be doing in the next week or two? What are you focusing on in elections right now? What has triggered your interest?
Oh, gosh, there's so much going on these days. I feel like looking at political influence is more important than ever. We're going into the inauguration next week. There's a number of different filing deadlines, looking at lobbying from the final quarter, as well as the final Federal Election Commission campaign finance filing from the 2024 cycle. So looking at the year end, as well as just looking at the new administration and the new lawmakers going into office. There's so much, whether it's what their conflicts of interests are, who's trying to curry favor with them and lobby them, or even just following the money. There's just so much going on right now. I'm really excited to dig into all of that and hopefully make it more accessible with Influence Brief.
So do you see a whole lot more problem in your lap now, working for free and fair elections with this new administration that really seems to most of us to be very autocratic? Are they going to come up with a whole new bag of tricks?
I think that there's unique issues to every administration, whether that's ties to corporations, to revolving door lobbyists who've been part of existing structures. Everyone is a bit unique. I think there's new problems for this administration that weren't present in the other, but everyone is just different. Biden presented certain issues that Trump does not, but certainly every administration has very unique issues. And I think one of the things about the new Trump administration is some of them are less common and more unprecedented than some of the others. So really being able to dig into who these nominees are that are potentially going to be leading agencies during the Trump administration, what their ties to lobbyists are, as well as the president's own business interests, which is something that I think is very, at least the specifics of the case, very unique to Trump, in a way that interests can potentially cozy up to the president more directly than was otherwise available.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a new gig. It's called Influence Brief. As I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the program, that's at www.influencebrief.com. So you want to tell listeners a little bit about what you're doing there?
Yes, thank you so much. I'm really excited to be able to launch Influence Brief and make information about political finances more accessible to everyone. While it was at Open Secrets, I really enjoyed digging into money and politics, to dark money, foreign influence, and I'm excited to really build on that and approach political influence generally. Increasingly, it's not just about what's reported in federal campaign finance filings. It's so much more diverse in the ways that political influence is seeking to influence the policies and even the outcomes of elections. The rise of online media has really changed the game. And there are just so many, as I mentioned before, with the new administration, there's so many new issues that really haven't been addressed before, many of which are not as easily quantifiable if we're just looking at the political disclosures and filings. So I'm really excited to dig into some of those new ways that different actors, whether that's industries, foreign actors, or just the billionaire next door are trying to influence the government.
One of the things I found very startling, we were talking about Elon Musk and all of his foreign influence and the foreign influences here. You know, he's got to the point where he was able to influence the war between Russia and Ukraine with his star satellites, the chain of satellites that he has, Starlink. He could interfere with communication. So we have this whole new level of trillionaire or billionaire trying to be a trillionaire influence that I don't remember being quite that way before.
I mean, certainly Musk is a really unique case, both in the amount of money he has at his disposal for all of this, but also his very complicated ties to different government interests. Multiple of his companies are contractors for the government, making millions and millions of dollars. So he certainly has interest there. You also, of course, have DOGE or D-O-G-E, the agency adjacent that Musk is involved in. And it really remains to be seen whether or not that's actually going to be something to improve the government systems. I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, or if it could potentially even benefit his own business interests. And so I think that there's a lot that remains to be seen.
It's a whole new revolving door has never been quite this big, I don't think.
One of the other organizations you're working with at Influence Brief, again, influencebrief.com, is something that was new to me. That's the Sunlight Research Center. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I'm really excited to direct investigations at Sunlight Research Center. We work with different journalists at different news outlets across the country to help support their investigative work when they have investigations, whether it's into campaign finances, political interest, or just investigations generally, digging into corruption or other big issues. When they want support on that, our team of researchers goes in and provides them with more in-depth information, as well as with tools and trainings to be able to really enhance their journalists and make sure that they have the resources they need. Increasingly with news deserts and so many local news outlets just not having a lot of resources, mm-hmm. I think it's so important to be able to bring in experts, to bring in those insights and make sure that they're equipped with the both tools as well as techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is Influence Brief Substack, right? Is that where it is?
Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. influencebrief.com. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I subscribed today.
Much appreciated.
I did want to mention something, but Substack is different, is it not? So you're at substack.com and then /@ Anna Lecta. So I don't know where the Lecta comes from, but Anna, A-N-N-A, and then L-E-C-T-A, Anna Lecta.
Yeah, it's just a username for that mm-hmm. part, but okay. influencebrief.com is probably the easier URL to remember since you can go directly to the newsletter with that.
Oh, okay. So same information at both sites?
Absolutely.
There? Okay.
Yes.
I imagine there's more at influencebrief.com, but okay, super. And one of the questions I want to ask, we have a couple minutes left, minute and a half. Any comment on one of my curiosities that's the big money, not in elections directly, but in parties, in the party structure. What is the big money doing to pay for the parties, pay for the employees, pay for their own existence year to year in between the elections, this kind of thing? And what kind of influence do you see that having on decisions which seem to go, you know, against the public interest? But nonetheless, what can you tell us about big money and the parties, funding the parties themselves?
Sure. So at its core, there's a lot of it. Mm-hmm. But certainly there's an evolving system at this point where it's not just the traditional party committees that you would think of when you think the Democratic and Republican Party. It's not just the RNC and the DNC anymore. Mm-hmm. It's a much bigger infrastructure that includes super PACs, even dark money groups that are supporting candidates, but also can hold it over candidates' heads when they go astray, when they vote against the party. And so mm-hmm. keeping people in line, it's also about political committee, congressional committee assignments. And there's just so many different moving parts to it that it's much bigger and more nuanced than just those traditional party committees. But certainly there is a corporate influence angle and also an incumbent advantage. It's a complicated system, but mm. certainly the parties wield a lot of interest, but in a way that's evolving, in particular with this new administration, with Trump very much leaving his mark on the Republican yeah. Party.
Well, we need to leave it there. Thank you very much. We have about 30 seconds left in the program. This has been Corporations and Democracy, speaking with Anna Masolia, the founder of her new outlet called Influence Brief at influencebrief.com. Thanks for being our guest.